You're listening to episode 196 of Women Worldwide. Your decision to use technology is a choice. How much? How little? When? So are you being intentional with your technology? Stay tuned to learn more. Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. I've spent an entire career helping women to share stories, nurture relationships, grow their brands, but most of all, to find their voices so they can make a difference. Do you feel stuck? Do you want to power up your own voice? Women Worldwide features the stories of passionate women who have navigated big career challenges and some of the toughest changes. These professionals offer deep insights and advice to inspire you and to help you uncover what's holding you back. Let Women Worldwide ignite your passion so you can excel in life. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning into another episode of Women Worldwide. I just want to take a moment to thank all of you for your support of the show. You're out there on social media. You're sharing and amplifying the stories of the amazing people who come on as guests, and you're really helping them to create impact and to make a difference. And we so appreciate this. Today's show, we're going to dive right in, is all about technology and stories. But we're going to be looking at the stories of elders across the country. Joining me on the show is Veronica Kieran, the author of the new book, Stories of Elders, What the Greatest Generation Knows About Technology That You Don't. A little more about Veronica. She was named by Forbes as a notable graduate of Grand Valley State University. She's a 40 under 40 business leader. She's been recognized as the founder of a top women-owned business. She offers entrepreneurial coaching to LGBTQ business owners through her signature self-care through scaling program so they work less, grow faster, and earn more. But rather than me going on and on about Veronica, she's here to share her story with you. Veronica, it's so great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Hello. Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Well, I love to hear that. So I know that when I was doing my due diligence about you and who you are, I picked up on something that you wanted to be an anthropologist, right? Yeah. At some point. And then suddenly, I guess my first question is, how do you go from wanting to be an anthropologist to becoming an entrepreneur and an author focused on
technology? Well, I'm still an anthropologist. That's the really cool thing about anthropology. That's why I still speak to my alma mater at the classes of seniors who are studying anthropology to remind them that anthropology is really the study of people, and cultural anthropologists are the study of living people. So Indiana Jones, he was an archaeologist. He was a study of past people. So I'm not doing that. I'm not going to find skeletons in the closet or anything like that. No snake pit for me.
Right. That's the first thing you think of, actually. As soon as I hear anthropologist, I think Indiana Jones.
Right. Yes. And so that's not me, but that is anthropology, but that is the anthropology of past peoples. I am a cultural anthropologist. I am a anthropologist of current peoples. And it actually marries perfectly to being an entrepreneur because anthropology teaches you to be able to have insight into others, especially if they are unlike you. And if you are running a business, you need to be able to see into the lives of your target markets or of your clients. You need to be able to kind of predict the future or predict the needs, the wants, the experiences of people who are not yourself and put yourself in their shoes. And so to that point, one time I was at a networking space like entrepreneurs do and talking to a gentleman who owned a tech company, not dissimilar to the one that I used to own. And he said to me, oh yeah, I would rather hire an anthropologist over somebody with a marketing degree any day of the week. I said, you betcha. Wow. But you know, I'm biased.
Well, it sounds like everybody should have a little bit of cultural anthropology behind them.
Yeah, I would agree. I have talked to many people who are in fields that are unrelated to anthropology, or what one might think, you know, IT or medical. And they still say to me that the anthropology class, the single one that they took, was extremely enjoyable. And I think it's healthy to be able to say, you know, my way is not the only way, maybe the best way for me. But there's a lot of people out there, and they're all very interesting, and they all have a lot to offer. I, again, biased here, but I definitely think that anthropology could benefit everybody.
Absolutely. So that kind of connection with technology and anthropology, and just the stories, your book, it sounds so interesting. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about the book and why you focused on elders.
Yeah, definitely. So the bridge between my anthropology experience and then getting to the book is the middle part, my entrepreneurial experience, because I was running a tech company. I started it in 2012, and in 2015, I started to notice that my behaviors were changing, my attitude toward communication, friends, family, all of that was starting to evolve and had started to become easier, seemingly, if not normal, dare I say, to simply send a digital message rather than pick up the phone and hear a human being on the other side, or even see them in person. And now I live in the icy north, so it's a lot easier to say, yes, digital messages are the thing I want to do because I do not want to go outside right now.
Right.
And so I could tell that this change was happening to me. I didn't like it. My anxiety and depression were growing because I didn't see people that I loved very often anymore. And at the same time in 2015, that's when the media started really taking hold of what is technology doing to us? What is it doing to our children's brain developments? What is it doing to society, community, culture, etc.? So I knew I wasn't the only one who was uncomfortable. What I noticed is that the people writing these articles overwhelmingly were below the age of 50. And now I admit I'm below the age of 50 as well. And thus, with humility, as an anthropologist, I say, I don't know what's going on. I don't know enough to know what's going on. They don't know what's going on. Who knows what's going on? And to me, that's where the elders come into play. They've lived approximately a lifetime, right, without technology. These are people who are born before 1945, so they're all above the age of 77 years old, and they grew up without running water or electricity in some cases. They can remember when the radio came into their home. They remember black and white television. They remember riding horses to school because not everybody had a car. And so that's the contrast I was looking for, the people that grew up without tech, so much so that now they really have a perspective on what's happening now.
Yeah, and such a different perspective, mm-hmm. I would think. And mm-hmm. I think that being able to experience no tech into tech can shed a lot of light. So that's really interesting. Did you notice anything? I think you went around the country capturing these stories. Mm-hmm. Was there, as you step back and you looked at your research, was there a common thread that kind of ran throughout these stories?
Yeah. So people have been asking me, you know, can you outline any sort of predictor for adoption for our elders? Because we like to say they don't want it, or they can't use it, or, you know, we have all these cliches. It's very, it bothers me. I find that my work has exposed a lot of ageism in our culture,
yes.
But I didn't find anything that predetermined whether or not somebody of a certain age would use or not use technology. What I found was a deep sense of intentionality that I have lived so long without this tool, I'm choosing if I want it in my life. And if I choose to have it in my life, how? How does it appear? And contrast that then to younger generations who say, oh, the new iPhone's out. I've got to get it right now. We talk about the Steve Jobs announcement for the iPod back in the day, quote, back in the day. But nobody knew that they needed an iPod until that speech. And then everyone needed an iPod, right? And so our elders are sitting back and they're saying, yeah, I, you know, the things that I've been doing, they're working still. Maybe I don't need that.
I may not need that.
Yeah. Or if I do, I want to use it in a very specific manner.
Do you think that younger generations, is it more knee-jerk reaction? Because the more you're exposed to this instantaneous, that's something about the expectation, like, you, and sometimes you don't even realize it, but you're clicking on the icon on your smartphone for Instagram too many times, mm-hmm. or you're looking, checking your email, right? Yeah. You don't even know you're doing it, but you're just looking at your email, clicking that icon.
Yeah.
So is that a knee-jerk reaction? We're programmed rather than intentional and saying, you know, I'm going to check my email at this time of the day because mm-hmm. I know I can go 5 hours and then check it again.
Yeah, I like the way you said it. I like that you said programmed. I think it is programmed, especially social media platforms. They are designed to be addictive. They're designed to play off of our minds in a very specific way, because the more viewing on the platform, the more ads that get shown, the more the company makes money. So they're not like this evil, you know, company that's coming after you and they want you to be addicted to their stuff. But they have to make money. And so they've designed it in a way that makes them make the most money, which is to play with the embedded evolutionary needs to socialize in our brains. And so in that way, I would say, yeah, there's a programming that's happening there. And what we know about our brains is that they stop developing around age 25. They really, you know, the different neurological structures really stop growing a whole lot after 25.
Isn't that, if I can interject, isn't that when you're capable? I know I've read somewhere that you're actually capable of making decisions and judgment at that age because your brain is fully developed. Is that true?
I can't speak to that specifically, but I believe I know of what you are talking about. I just don't want to confirm it because I don't have the articles in front of me. But yeah, 25 is a really important age. And so if you're 25 and you've had some exposure at the very least to technology culturally or actually in your life, then you're more likely to kind of see it as a norm, as opposed to somebody who came of age without any sort of high technology in sight, you know, before World War II, they're probably going to notice the knee-jerk reaction or the programming that's happening a lot easier. I wouldn't right. say definitively, but I would say a lot easier than somebody who, you know, I grew up having to memorize phone numbers and going door to door to see if my friends were home. But tech came around before, the internet came around before I turned 25. So my brain is kind of used to it in a way that makes me vulnerable, I guess I would say, to programming.
All right. This is also fascinating. I'm curious, does any story of an elder stick out in your mind?
So this is the hardest question, actually, because all
gotta
of
ask
them
those
stand
tough
out.
Questions.
Yeah, I know. That's right. That is your job, and you are doing a good one.
Right. thank you. I appreciate that.
So one of my favorites, simply because there's such a stark contrast between a couple generations, is Edwin Gould. And any military or tech junkie will know of this person. He is responsible for being on the team that engineered our first spy satellite during the Cold War.
Oh.
So in the book, he goes on for quite a long time. He's describing in detail how this stuff worked. And may I remind your listeners that during the Cold War, we did not have digital photography. So not only did he create a satellite that goes into space and functions, but also then he created the way to get the film back to Earth and then develop it.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
We can't even imagine that, right?
No, I know we can't.
This is so far beyond our brains.
Right. He says at one point, he says, my father electrified New Hampshire. I flew spy satellites. That's quite a quantum leap in one generation. And he is right. And that, wow. I mean, that's a sliver. And that took place, you know, 75 years ago. Now look at what we've got. Look at the leaps we've made now. So I think that his life is a very good example of this shift that we're experiencing.
Well, it certainly is an amazing shift. Just a little more about your book. Was there anything, any challenges or as you were going along in the writing or the publishing process? I know a lot of listeners, they have stories that they want to share.
Yeah.
And I tend to hear people ask about the publishing process.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. I've been asked actually several times too. And I feel a little bit spoiled. I co-host another podcast, as a matter of fact, called Angles of Latitude, with Attitude, Latitude, two T's. It's for entrepreneurs. And so we have all kinds of people on there. And my co-host orchestrated it so I would be interviewing someone who owns a publishing house strategically, because I was at the time looking for a publisher. So I kind of cheated. I didn't mean to cheat, but it just worked out that this publishing house specializes in unique nonfiction. They're called Identity Publications out of San Diego.
Oh, cool.
And it just worked out where we continued the conversation after that interview. And then he flew out to see me at my home and kind of discuss a deal further. So I really got lucky, I would say, but, you know, I didn't have to go through the proposal process, but what I did have to go through was taking 100 interviews, which amounted to about 8,400 years of stories, and have to boil that down into a book. And so I ended up working with an author coach, which if you're ever stuck and you don't know what to do, I always recommend coaching. I mean, I'm a coach, so, you know, I'm the preacher singing to the choir.
Yeah.
So I worked with an author coach for a short period of time. Her name is Morgan Gist McDonald, and she is the founder of Paper Raven Publishing. And she really helped me kind of get on track and figure out how do I even begin to manage all of this content and put it into a book.
Amazing. So it sounds like you had first of all, the guests in the podcast seat, right? It's always an opportunity to do something with somebody, which I find is wonderful. So using that as an opportunity, kudos to you. And you should do that with every guest moving forward.
I agree.
Right? Yeah. It's so good because you're meeting people, and what do we crave? We crave learning from each other. We're human. We want to interact and collaborate.
Exactly.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I went after those stories. We talk about history facts. I'm not going to learn anything from facts and figures. I'll learn from stories though.
That's right. Culture and people, mm-hmm. which is your profession. I'm curious. So you mentioned the author coach, mm-hmm. which that is a part of your support system. Were there any other things that you relied on as support or people who sort of lifted you up as you were writing and publishing?
Yeah, there is another author that I happened to meet about a year and a half into my process. And she's local to me. Her name is Rachel Style, and she's the author of Running in Silence. And so her book came out when I was about halfway through my process and kind of really swimming deep into it. And since she's a nonfiction writer, I kind of just decided that we were going to be friends and that she was going to be my life. And thank goodness that she decided that was a good idea too. But, you know, so we had coffee several times.
Nice.
Now, of course, I call her family. I mean, we see each other quite often and collaborate on different projects. We just did one. This is a minor tangent, but we just did one where they're building an audiobook documentary of a man's mother's poetry, which he found after she passed away, about her eating disorder and depression, which was really cool. So so Rachel and I keep going, and she provided that kind of support system before I had the coach, before I had the publisher. She was like my little cheerleader, and I'm so thankful for her. I'm so thankful.
Well, that's amazing in and of itself, but I really appreciate what you said about, I decided she was going to be my friend.
Yeah. Yep. That's what happened.
That's right. And she wanted to be your friend, and then look at the great things.
Yeah.
That have happened.
Thankfully we actually get along, and you know, she's a good hearted human. And so am I.
Well, it sounds that way. Absolutely. And, you know, as you're going through any process, I just know, especially my writing process, you do tend to surround yourself with people who are positive, who will lift you up, who will help you do great things. Because it's not easy. You know, just what you said about all the stories. And I was even going to ask you, how long did it actually take from the time you started your research to publishing your book? Which was recently published.
Yes. So the book came out September 30th. It took 3.5 years from inception in February 2015 to publishing 2018.
Amazing. Well, congratulations for that. And Veronica, I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts just for a moment, because I want to take a little time to share my experience with our sponsor, PrepDish. And I don't know, have you ever heard of PrepDish before?
I am only vaguely familiar with them.
Okay, well, I'm going to make you more familiar.
Yeah.
So, and for everybody else who doesn't know about PrepDish, it's a subscription-based meal planning service that really saves you time and helps you to make your dinners much more appealing. And so I can say that from experience. For me, PrepDish removes some annoying questions that I heard far too often. The one that was, what are we having for dinner? And it's 5 o'clock and you clearly don't know. You have to throw it together. And yeah. The other one was, it wasn't really a question. It was more when you tell them what they're having, they go, oh, not again. So that's kind of annoying and things you just don't want to hear at the dinner hour. So you're probably wondering, Veronica, just how does this PrepDish work?
Yeah, curious, because I'm a busy entrepreneur. And I'll tell you what, there's some days that I just kind of crash into the pantry and pull out whatever I can find.
Right, crash and pull. That was probably the story of my life before. All right, well, every week you get a weekly meal plan and a grocery list. And you know up front all the ingredients that you're going to need to prep for that week. So you go and you do your shopping and you set aside some time for the prepping. It could be 2 or 3 hours, depending on the recipes for that week. I prep on Sundays, sets me up for the entire week. You pick whatever day is best for you, Veronica. And this week, I made a couple of dishes to add to the faves list, the kale salad with pomegranate and avocado. I love kale. Mm-hmm. And I also made a sausage and sauteed bell peppers over rice dish. But I just want to say to my vegan and vegetarian friends.
Like me.
Yay. Okay. So I substituted the meat sausage for the soy vegetable sausage, which worked out very, very nicely. So you might want to check out those recipes. You know what? There's other delicious recipes as well. And if you think about it, your meals get easy. Mine did, because I'm saving time. And that is so precious when you're in business and you're running around and your days are crazy. And with my crazy schedule, I just let PrepDish do the planning for me. But here's the best part, Veronica. PrepDish has a special offer. It's to all Women Worldwide listeners. You can go to PrepDish.com/worldwide and get 2 weeks of PrepDish for free. I know you're going to love it. Try it. PrepDish.com/worldwide. And I'm excited for listeners because it's so easy.
Yeah.
All right. So let's just dive right back into our discussion. Veronica, we were chatting about your book, Stories of Elders. Different generations, how elders have more intention. And we were talking about kind of your research and the publishing process. But I want to pivot to you. And while you were learning all these stories, which is really interesting, and publish them, I'm wondering what you actually learned about yourself throughout this journey. Maybe you can share a little bit about that.
Well, I've got two takeaways. One is specifically related to technology, and then one is just tangential. It happened. So I'll start with that. I drove 12,000 miles in 6 weeks through 40 states in order to get these interviews.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So that's, you know, as you can imagine, pedal to the metal. I was eating, sleeping, interviewing, or driving. And sometimes I was eating and driving at the same time. That was all I had time for. I had originally envisioned a much more leisurely experience. I got a national parks all park pass. And so I could stop in the national parks and really kind of do my Americana due diligence, but I simply just did not have time.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah. Right? And so I really actually hurt myself because I have post-traumatic stress injury. It's the same as post-traumatic stress disorder. It's being recoined. And so to be under that much stress for 6 weeks, I got home and I crashed. And what I learned from that experience, ladies and gentlemen, is that self-care is very important. And if you want to have a baby book or a baby business or anything else that you want to put forth in your life, if you are not okay, nothing else will be okay. So it took me at least 6 months to actually get back on the horse and start processing through all of the interviews that I had recorded. I just needed to be burned out and not touch it. And there was a moment in time where I was like, oh my God, is this book even going to get written? Because I just worked myself way too hard. So that is number one for sure. The second one is, of course, much more related to the topic of the book, what I learned. And that really is about the intentionality. And I'll bring it down even further. I always was a little bit choosy about how much tech was in my life, but now I purposely don't look at the phone when I first wake up in the morning. I've realized it's kind of like turning on a fire hose when your brain isn't awake yet. And so it throws you right into fight or flight mode. So don't do that. Yes. Yeah, it is though. I mean, here's all the information of the entire world coming at you live. That's going to throw you into fight or flight mode. So I'm taking a little bit better care of my brain. I allow myself to walk away from the computer. There's a couple different models for this. There are smart tech like Fitbit or Bella Beat that will buzz at you if you're not moving enough. But there's also, you can use the Pomodoro technique. And so it says, hey, after 20 minutes, you need to get up and move around. Because it turns out our bodies were designed to move. But also, our eyes can't look at a screen that long. And so I allow myself to say, you know, I'm kind of sick of looking at this. I need to walk away and not feel guilty for doing that. And one of the elders in particular, she started noticing how tech was really affecting her life and how she was seeing her friends and everything. And so she started having monthly tea parties, which I just love so much.
Oh,
and
I love that.
All of the people who attend are not allowed to have their technology out. They must leave their phones at the door or don't bring them at all. And I said, I'm going to do that. So I've been hosting monthly brunches because all of my friends are entrepreneurs and very busy people. So if we're not intentional about seeing one another, we don't see one another. And then I have no idea what's going on in their lives. So they all come over. We make food together. We hang out outside if it's nice out or inside if it's not. And it's like family time.
Yes, it sure is. And I'm just curious, do you think it's hard for your entrepreneur friends to come over at brunch or maybe just in the beginning and to not like to leave their phones at the door and not want to check or like do that Instagram post?
Yeah, yeah. It's totally hard to not want to like update your story and say like, hello, look at me, look at my life. I'm influencing, you know, what's it's definitely habit building. Even just to get them show up is habit building. There were times where I'm like, hey, where are you? Are you still my friend? Are you coming over? And they're like, I forgot, you know, even if you put it on social media, they forget. So
of course,
the whole concept, the whole like getting people to come over regularly is habit building.
It's muscle memory, right? It has to be built into your brain. It's something that's an automatic.
Yeah.
New habits, better habits have to be formed.
Yeah.
And having brunch and making your food together, gosh, it's such a good habit.
Yeah, it's really nice. We just had Friendsgiving a couple days ago, and that was just, my house was full of, I think, like 30 people. And my house, I own a duplex, so my apartment within my house is probably 900 square feet. It's laid out pretty well, so I can fit people for sure, but they're on the floor, they're on the couch, they're standing and eating. I have friends with anxiety, and I try and build a really safe space. So there was, the kitchen was like the safe space once everybody was eating, so there'd be one or two people kind of milling about. Kind of taking a break from the social stimuli. It's just nice. It's just so
nice. It's really nice. I was talking to a young woman in Spain who was saying that she was doing a Friendsgiving, but they were actually renting an Airbnb. And yeah, so they were going to, you know, they'd all check in at whatever time, have their, do their shopping, do their cooking, have their Friendsgiving meal, clean up and move out the next day. And that way it was in no one's home.
Yeah. You know? And then they stick around. Right. I'm guessing you're implying that they stayed overnight as well. So you can kind of just keep going.
That's right. You can't really do that with 30 people unless you're renting that mansion.
Actually, there is one on Lake Michigan that we could do it at.
Cool.
Yeah, it's like a big 5-bedroom. But yeah, I love that idea because sometimes you don't necessarily want it to end, but like you're tired. You can say, okay, we're going to bed now, and people can go to bed in their own time. And then you wake up in the morning and you make brunch together. And that's nice. That sounds really nice.
Yeah, I think it is really nice. So I want to ask you, we talked about how if you're checking your phone, you're not posting to Instagram as an influencer. Mm-hmm. How are you using technology to promote your book?
Oh my gosh. Well, even to fund my book. So I successfully ran a Kickstarter, which became a staff pick, which is their highest honor.
Congratulations. That's cool.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I was very excited when that happened. So I would not have done the research. I wouldn't have made it 12,000 miles without that funding. So technology has been utterly critical. I found the people I interviewed through technology as well. I did the entrepreneurial thing where I networked, but I picked up the phone and I called people and then I sent out emails and then I put it on social media. I ended up finding people through Reddit and then through the Kickstarter as well. So even just finding people was critical. And then recording, I actually, embarrassingly enough, lost one of my memory cards before I backed it up, but I'd done redundant recordings. So I had the audio still, the video for two people is no longer in my access. Who knows where it is? It might have gotten run over on the road. So maybe it doesn't exist at all. But so I still, you know, the redundancy that can happen through using a DSLR camera and then a audio mic and then a smartphone just to make sure, you know, thank goodness. And you couldn't, it would just be so much harder to do without the high tech that we have. So technology has played a critical role to the building of the book and then to market it. Yeah, you know, I mean, we're running Amazon ads and algorithms or playing with the algorithms and getting the reviews on Goodreads and sending it out to podcasters like yourself and networking to bookstores and conferences. And all that's being done mostly digital through email. So and then the website, of course, houses the mini podcast, which has the interviews. So if you're reading the book, but you want to hear so-and-so's accent because they grew up at one of the gentlemen, I say.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah. I mean, I say he pronounces.
Added value.
It is. Oh, it's so good. So, and that's still going.
So smart.
That's why I encourage people to sign up for the email list, not just to see where the events are, but also to get the latest episodes of the podcast as it goes out. Because unfortunately, I'm not regular with it. I'm so busy doing signings, but.
No, that's good news though.
The pros and the cons.
What a good problem to have.
Yeah. And so that's, and then to circle it back, that's where intentionality comes even more in play in my life. It's like, gosh, I haven't seen my friend in quite a while. I better call her up, you know, and kind of get back down from the cloud of excitement and nurture the relationships in my life and make sure that they don't suffer while all this is happening.
Yeah, that's so important. You know, you mentioned different ways, right, that you're using technology and how it all came together, which is really a good, smart approach and intentional, like you said. I'm just curious, do you think it's a combination of all the things that you're doing? So you mentioned the Amazon ads, you said the reviews and Goodreads, the way that you're, you know, interacting with podcasters and getting on shows, you're doing book signings. Is there any one thing that is moving the needle, or do you feel like it's a combination of everything?
I think it's a combination of everything, honestly.
And that's good to know. I mean,
I do see people who feel overwhelmed by the marketing of their books. You know, I've done some signings where it's like a local author night, so it's more than one author. Most of the time, my events are solo, but I've done two where they're, I say most of the time, it's only been a month and a half. But I've already had
so many events.
It's been, and I was already speaking. I'm used to speaking as an entrepreneur and coach. But so when I've done them together, people ask about marketing because most people have an inkling, at least, that the publishing world has changed.
Yes.
They know, you know, the Kindle's a thing now. Ebooks are no longer considered a cruddy way to go, or self-publishing is no longer considered a cruddy way to go. It's actually seen as like the stepping stone into the publishing world. Yes, it is. And I mean, I'm thankful I have a publisher who understands a lot of this framework. And so I don't have to worry too much about it. You know, like I'm not actually running the Amazon side of things at all. They're handling everything. But I see a lot of overwhelm for authors who are self-publishing. And yeah, I do say that it's a combination of things, kind of like a scatter or shotgun approach to marketing. But I also encourage authors to really, really think about what they want to happen to their book so that they can do the right research in order to learn the skills that they need in order to achieve that goal. And if they realize they don't have the skills, then figure out how to hire for those skills, especially for self-publishing, because self-publishing really actually these days is becoming an entrepreneur. You're an entrepreneurial author.
Yeah. Yeah. You make a great point. If you don't have the skills, and technology and social media and all the ways that you market requires new skills, if you don't have that, then you need to surround yourself with people who can do this for you. Very important. Mm-hmm. What do you think is your, or has been your biggest challenge as an entrepreneur and an author, just looking back?
As an entrepreneur, it was learning that lesson, what I just said, where I need to, you can't rely on Google all the time. You do need humans who can filter and describe this situation that you're in as unique. So you need to focus here instead of there. They filter the information overload that's on Google for you and act as guides. I had a mentor for a short period of time when I first started my business. He passed away suddenly from a heart attack. So I was left kind of like relying too heavily on Google for quite a long time. And it was a period of time when coaching wasn't actually that popular. And if it had been, I think I would have been better off because I would have grown my business faster. And I eventually sold that tech company and it would have all just happened faster and better and with less stress.
Oh, sure.
And I think the same thing kind of goes for my book, that I was really swimming in it until I met Morgan at Paper Raven. I ended up finding her on accident through the Female Entrepreneurial Association. Carrie interviewed her and it was like a free, you know, just 10 minute quickie video. And I was like, I need this person. Oh my God, I don't even know what to do.
Right. Look how the accident, something so positive.
Yeah. And just, but hearing somebody who said like, you can do this, and validating what direction to go in, I was stuck before that moment in time.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. Maybe you could also share what success looks and feels like to you every day.
Every day, did you say?
Yeah,
Day. Every day.
Yeah. What makes you feel like I'm a success today? I know that's a really hard question, right?
It's a hard question, but yeah. If I feel that I moved the needle in some way, so myself and my assistant are always pitching to conferences, either about the book or about the work that I do as an entrepreneur, and trying to build collaborations with co-working spaces and incubators. So if I feel like maybe I didn't hear back from any of those, you don't always hear back right away, but if I feel that I got some of that done, I feel like I moved the needle personally. And then I've got to tell you, I have an AB work week. So there's days where I work only on the business, and there's days where I take meetings or interviews, and that's when I work with my clients. And those days I walk away just feeling almost like high off of my clients because the work they're doing is so cool and we have so much fun together.
Great.
And to see them realizing their vision. Oh, wow. It's just so much fun.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I can imagine how gratifying that is. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to ask you to kind of wrap it up a little bit with some advice for listeners. What do you say to all the women worldwide listeners out there who want to take big, bold steps to do something different in their lives and their careers? What's your advice?
Just start. Honestly, just start. If you have the inkling that you want to do something, you already have what you need inside of you in order to do it. You might not know every step. You might not have actually all the tools in your toolkit, but you have what it takes to find those tools and you have what it takes to make those steps. So just start. And along the way, you will find the resources, you will find the people, you will find the tools to make it happen. But it is completely feasible. You just have to start.
Right. And look at the people who landed in your path, Veronica. Perfect example. Exactly. And you just started. That's great advice. Okay. Last question. Mm-hmm. Super easy.
Okay.
Where can people find out more about you and your book?
Yeah, they can find me on all of the social media at VM Kieran. It's V, Veronica, M, Marie, Kieran, K-I-R-I-N, like the Japanese beer. And they can check out the book at storiesofelders.com.
Cool. All right. Well, Veronica, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, taking the time. Your book is really interesting, and so appreciate your insights about technology and sharing the story of elders. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. And I also want to thank Prep-Dish for sponsoring this episode of Women Worldwide. And don't forget, you can get your free 2-week trial by going to prepdish.com, and make sure you check out that special trial offer for 2 weeks, prepdish.com/worldwide. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in and helping us to power up the voices and the passion, and for fueling the Women Worldwide Network. We really appreciate it. And if you have a moment, just share how you're feeling. Rate us on iTunes. Give us a shout out on Twitter or Facebook. We always love to hear from you. Okay, friends, until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.